hailing frequencies are open. Welcome to the Infinite Potato Alliance.
Do we want to drop in some parts of the soundtrack from Star Trek IV? Because it's way worse than I remember.
What are you talking about?
I will admit I was having some trouble with the we'll call it the 1980s era music. I mean, the orchestrations in the 23rd century are fine, but once you start getting the horns coming in for their walking through the streets of San Francisco, ouch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ouch. And that was brutal.
And that punk music from the guy on the bus was bad.
You know, it literally was from the guy on the bus, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Okay. He was also in Spider-Man.
He was also
playing a punk.
He was also in Star Trek Short Treks, Ephraim and Dot.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. That's right. That's right.
The punk on the bus was the narrator of that short.
The narrator?
Yeah.
Ephraim and Dot had a narrator?
Yeah.
It's been so long since I saw it. I don't remember.
Yeah. There was,
I don't remember anybody talking. I just remember that being like a Tom and Jerry type cartoon.
Mm-hmm. But the whole thing had a voiceover to carry you through the story. And that was the punk on the bus in Star Trek IV that did all that narration.
The thing I remember about that short is that they blew up the wrong ship. I mean, I've meant to go back and watch it again to see if they've gone back and fixed it the way that they did the guy in the blue jeans on the Mandalorian that they went back and erased. Mm-hmm. But I'm betting they didn't.
No, probably not. But before we start on the next episode, since we're talking about soundtracks, I was doing some transcribing for my my Planet Rise gig yesterday, I was listening to the soundtrack for Star Trek III. Now, Tom, do you have that soundtrack?
No, I have the Astral Symphony, which was a collection of from like all the original movies.
Oh, okay. I was listening through and I'm recognizing all, you know, most of the music and most of the cues, and I hear it and I can picture what happens on screen while that music is going on because we watched those movies so many times. But then you get to the end of the soundtrack and there's a track titled The Search for Spock. And I think if I play it now, it'll come out my computer and my microphone should pick it up. So have a quick listen.
Oh my goodness.
I can see the fog machine already.
Let's jump ahead here.
Now, is that in the film? That's not in the film.
Oh, no. I mean,
must have been the German release.
I don't know what this was. It looks as though it comes from the from the original soundtrack, the James Horner soundtrack. But it's almost like it's a bonus track. It's right at the end of the disc, at the end of the album. It's after the end title sequence. I don't know what it was for. I don't know why they made it, but it's there. And for the keen ears, you can hear all of the recurring themes and motifs from the previous tracks. You know, the main title theme and the end credits and all the interstitial stuff. You recognize all the melodies, but yikes.
All right. Let's go ahead and start. So,
Welcome
Welcome to That Star Trek Podcast.
I am the Guardian of Forever.
This is your place for detailed analysis and speculation of all things Trek.
Double dumbass on you!
Join us as we dive into the newest content coming available, as well as retrospectives of the past series and films.
All hands aboard the ship!
Now, on with the show.
I'll see you in 500 years,
and I'll see you in a few minutes.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of That Star Trek Podcast, your place for detailed analysis and speculation of all things Trek. My name is Sean Ray, and this is the show that knows that in the Mirror Universe, it's called The Possible Burger. Joining me tonight on the program, we have Tom. How's it going, sir?
It's going well.
And no, Scott is here as well.
Hello, computer.
But Tom, your name on the screen is Nuclear Wessels. You changed it a minute ago, but it was cut off. Was that supposed to say Spock and Savick's love child?
Yes, it was. And that's why I changed it, because it was cut off.
Yeah.
Who we never, ever got to see.
Yeah, I know. So we're going to jump right into the topic. We're continuing our look at all of the Star Trek episodes and films that heavily rely on time travel as a plot device. Tonight, we're finishing up our adventures with the crew of the original series with Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, which was written by Steve Meerson and Peter Kreiks, Harve Bennett and Nicholas Meyer, directed by Leonard Nimoy. The release date was November 26, 1986. The IMDb description says, to save Earth from an alien probe, Admiral James T. Kirk and his fugitive crew go back in time to San Francisco in 1986. To retrieve the only beings who can communicate with it, humpback whales. So before we actually talk about the plot of the movie, I want to get you guys, let's get your history with the film and what you think of the film. Scott, what's your first memory of this film? And do you like it?
I'm pretty sure that my first memory of this film is sitting in the theater to watch it. And it's quite possible that this is the last time that I was in a movie theater with our mother.
Oh, really?
Was she that? Well, first off, Tom, did we see this in the theater? Am I making this up?
I don't know. I think we did. So I don't think you're making that up. And it very well could be the last time that we saw one with her. Not that she's dead or anything.
Your mom's just not big on movies.
It started to sound really dark.
Yeah, that you guys were so you misbehaved so badly that she would never go to the movies with you again.
Well, column A, column B. No, she's fine. I talked to her this week. It's cool. She just doesn't go to the movie theaters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And since I'm pretty sure that I don't have to worry about our dad hearing this show, I'll go ahead and say that I don't think that I'm going to be seeing movies in the movie theater with dad. Because I took him to see Rogue One, and I'm not taking him to movies anymore. Because Dad doesn't know how to whisper in a movie theater.
Well, when they get older, they can't hear as well. So whispering becomes very loud when they get older.
to be there in the movie theater during Rogue One, and to hear your father sit next to you say in full voice, "Is that supposed to be Tarkin?"
Oh man. Tom, what about you? I mean, I assume it's the same memory, but
yeah, what? Theater? No, I never saw it in the theater. Yeah, I mean that's the original. You know, I'm pretty sure we would have seen this in the theater. I remember seeing number 5, like going myself or with some friends. So I could very well see us going to the theater for this. And then since then, I mean, we had it on VHS. I've had it DVD copies. This is one that, like, I work IT in schools, and during the summer, I've been pretty much on my own for the last several years, and I'm going around doing stuff. I will put this, and I'll actually put most of the Star Trek movies on, just the audio in my earbuds while I'm working. So, you know, I can recite, you know, by pitch and word and everything, you know, most of these movies, but mm-hmm. this one really stands out.
Yeah, this one, I would have to say this one probably got the most play in the house, because for a long time, while people would still maintain that Star Trek II is the best one, I think this one might edge it out as far as popularity, only because it was, in my opinion, possibly the most accessible of the TOS movies.
Much more mainstream, mm-hmm. much more family friendly than Wrath of Khan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. My memory of this is I saw Star Trek II on television. When I was a kid, I had seen episodes of Star Trek, but they were usually in the background. I wasn't like watching Star Trek when I was a little kid. But sometime around 87, 88, something like that. I remember Next Generation was actually on. So it had to be after 87. They showed The Wrath of Khan on television, like the NBC Night at the Movies or something like that. And I watched it with my dad. He had seen it before. And I saw the death of Spock. And then my dad says to me, yeah, but he comes back to life in the next movie. So I was like, what? Well, I have to see the next movie. So the next weekend, we went to the video store and rented Star Trek III and Star Trek IV and watched them both that weekend. So that's my first memory of this one. And when I was a kid, this was my favorite one because it was funny. It was different. It had time travel in it, which I've always been a fan of time travel stories. And there's really no villain in this movie. Which was, for me at the time, you know, that was different. There's no bad guy. You know, the bad guy is time. They're running out of it, you know?
Yeah, so, it's a combination. Burn. Time is their enemy. That's from DS9, later season, like fifth or sixth season. I think Children of Time, I think, is the name of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Defiant is thrown 200 years into the past. Yeah, Worf telling the Klingon tribe that time is their enemy. That was a long walk for an obscure quote.
Yep. Now, Tom, I wanted to talk to you about something because a little bit of history. Leonard Nimoy directed The Search for Spock. He had been under constraints, and his movie was not, he didn't really get to make the movie that he envisioned. And the movie was not that well received outside of the U.S. So when this movie came out, they released it as The Voyage Home, Star Trek IV, small underneath that. And there was a monologue of Kirk at the beginning where he describes everything that happened in Star Trek 2 and 3. And you've got that version, right?
At least I did at one point. I had a digital copy, so
I've never seen it. Can you describe it?
It's done as a captain's log voiceover.
Yeah. And
where Shatner recaps the events of from the death of Spock. So really that recap scene from Search for Spock.
Yeah.
Through those events. I mean, it's, geez, probably only a minute or two long. Just to give a recap of number three, because it did so poorly in those foreign audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just jump right in with the theme and stuff. So not that it's going to help anyone else watching, but I shared a video in our group chat earlier today. Did you either of you.
I didn't get a chance to watch it. No,
neither did I.
It's just showing the differences between the Blu-ray release and the DVD release, and they put the scene in there.
Okay.
And it just as an explanation that it's on some of the DVD releases.
Yeah, it's just funny that, I mean, did they think they were going to put out a poster that had Kirk and Spock over the Golden Gate Bridge and people weren't going to look at it and say, oh, that's a Star Trek movie? No, they're going to look at it and say, oh, The Voyage Home, that looks like a good movie. Let's go. It can't be anything like that Star Trek movie we watched a couple of years ago. By the way, I watched this last night. If you're listening to this and you haven't seen Star Trek IV in a while, it's available to watch for free on Pluto. So if you go to Pluto TV, I think just about all the Star Trek movies are on there right now and all the Star Trek series. So go check that. If you don't want to pay for Paramount Plus, but you want to watch some Star Trek, Pluto TV is where it's at. What do they use the Golden Gate Bridge for in the 23rd century? They don't have cars. It's just there as a historical monument now, I guess.
Because we see it
in Star Trek, they go to San Francisco all the time because that's where Starfleet headquarters is. So anytime they go to Earth, they're almost always going to San Francisco. And we always see an establishing shot of the Golden Gate Bridge. But there's no cars in Star Trek, so they don't really need that bridge.
I've got something in the back of my head that there is scenes of the Golden Gate Bridge with some kind of transit on it. Like
maybe they turned it into some kind of a train or something like that.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if it's some type of people mover.
Yeah,
think back to the imagine Disney World's monorail.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably something like that. You get in a little car and it'll just zip you across and back again. Like the little shuttle compartments that you had on Babylon 5 that would run you from one end of the station to the other.
Yeah.
Probably something like that. And a landmark. They're not going to take that down.
No. I wouldn't expect that they'd tear it down. I just wondered what use it is in the future.
All right. I just checked it out, and there's an image. I'm not sure which episode or what it was in. It's covered in like solar panels.
Oh, well, maybe they're using it for an energy source, yeah. I guess. All right. In 2286, an enormous cylindrical probe moves through space, sending out an indecipherable signal and disabling the power of every ship it passes. With all the money that they saved by setting the majority of this film in present day Earth, you would have thought they'd do more than just take a piece of black pipe and call it a probe. I know they said that Nimoy based it off of a book cover for Arthur C. Clarke that had a probe on it or had some kind of a ship on it, but it's very plain. It's just whatever. Yeah. Just take that piece of pipe right there and film it. We'll make that into the probe. It takes up orbit around Earth. It disables the global power grid. It generates planetary storms. It's creating catastrophic sun blocking cloud cover. And Starfleet Command sends out a distress call telling everyone to stay away from Earth. And at the same time, the Enterprise was, the Enterprise was destroyed in the previous movie. That's one of the big things. If this is your first Star Trek movie, you're like, why are they in that big green ship? The crew are still on Vulcan. They're preparing to take their bird of prey that they captured in the last movie, and they're going to return to Earth to face up to the charges against them. But they get the warning on their way back where they're saying, don't come to Earth. And they immediately, they listen to that probe, the noise that it's making. They make a bunch of logic jumps. And in about 30 seconds, they figure out that it's trying to talk to humpback whales. I mean, it's very quick how they come up with that.
How they come up with something that the entire the combined intellect of Starfleet Command on Earth didn't even occur to them.
Starfleet Command and every ship that that had their power knocked out and everything that had approached the probe or been in the vicinity of the probe, nobody had figured that out. But Spock, who's only been alive for 3 months, he just came back to life, and he figured it out like that. Super Spock. They decide, Kirk decides, all right, we're going to go back in time, get some humpback whales and bring them back. And just like that, that's what we're going to do. This is what we're doing. And they use their tried and true slingshot method, which they've never tried with anything other than the Enterprise. There was no, this thing was really coming apart when they started approaching like warp 9 and everything. This thing was shaking, coming apart. Things were blowing up around the bridge and all that kind of stuff.
Bulkheads are cracking.
Yeah.
Unidentified gases are just spilling out.
Probably. And then they go around the sun, and then Kirk starts having some kind of a vision. He starts seeing the heads of all of his crew. He starts hearing their voices saying things that they don't say until later in the movie. and it's just a whole mind trip. And then we never see them come out of it. We just see like water, and then they land, or no, they're not landing. They come out of the atmosphere. They're like coming down towards Earth, and they have to cloak because they're already detectable by radar, and they land this Klingon bird of prey in Golden Gate Park and it's cloaked. So it's invisible. Which is a funny scene because there's these two garbage men. And why is it that whenever there are characters that are not central to the plot, but we need to have them in mid-conversation, they're always talking smack about their wife. That's what the conversation always is. You know, I told her there's no way I'm paying $60 for a toaster oven.
I think that might have been one of my first curses. And it was an accident. Because I think I had this vague memory of being in school and talking about having seen this movie. And this was after it was on home video, so I had seen it plenty of times, and I knew the scene. And I'm describing the conversation between the garbage man and just completely lost in the moment. I went on to the next line and says, if you think I'm going to pay $60 for a damn
Oops, sorry. Kirk and Spock discover, okay, well, they hide the HMS Bounty that they named the Klingon Bird of Prey. They hide it in Golden Gate Park.
Such a sloppy paint job on the side of that ship with HMS Bounty. You would think that the Vulcans would have a little bit more attention to detail.
Oh, you know, those Vulcans are just like, oh.
What are they doing? Freehand painting on the side of a bird of prey is not logical.
Well, they were also probably really anxious to get the crew out of there because, and I know, Scott, I mentioned this to you once before about this, the fart joke that Kirk has. So before they leave Vulcan, Scotty's telling them, you know, oh, we've got this done, and I replaced the Klingon food packs. It was giving me a sour stomach. And Kirk goes, oh, is that what it was? Just this, like, throwaway line. He almost mumbles it, and you can barely hear it. Only the, what, you know, 30 years of repeated viewings, and I finally realized, you know.
Yeah, oh. And there's no almost about it. It was a mumble because it's Shatner. Of course he's going to mumble it. I never knew that's what he said until you pointed it out. And especially since Scotty was coming over the communication system with that last line. So it was giving me a stomach is what I heard. And then it would just be Shatner.
Yeah, I watched it last night, and I remember Scotty saying it was giving him a sour stomach, but I did not hear what Kirk said after that. That's funny.
Oh, it was obvious. He said,
So is there no way for Starfleet to know where the crew is? Because Vulcan is a Federation planet. So are they not obligated to tell Starfleet, hey, you know, the crew that you're looking for, they're right here. Because what I'm not understanding is they've been there for 3 months. And you think in 3 months they could send some kind of a scout ship that would maybe pass in the vicinity close enough to Vulcan to where they could pick up a signal from that Klingon bird of prey that they know was involved in this incident a few months ago. But not only that, the Klingons are really pissed. You think they wouldn't be looking for that ship and they wouldn't be searching for the signal?
I assumed that everyone knew where they were, that, you know, Kirk and company were there. They were just like, under asylum.
I'm surprised that the Klingons had not taken care of business on their own by then.
Well, they
pretty much stranded on Vulcan.
This has been, remember, this is back in the 23rd century. They had a neutral zone back then. In the 24th century, it was with the Romulans, but 23rd century, there was a Klingon neutral zone.
Yeah.
So they would have to violate that in order to try to take their own ship and the Starfleet crew that stole it off of Vulcan. And if they tried, they wouldn't succeed anyway.
And look, you were already having the hearings with the Klingon ambassador there. He's pitching a fit about everything. Sarek comes in and puts him in his place, you know, and points out, you know, all the things that this Klingon crew, which, if I remember right, even that crew, they weren't like officially sanctioned. They were, you know, pirates basically.
Yeah, they were rogue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Krug and his crew were definitely going rogue on that.
Well, they hid the bounty in Golden Gate Park. Man, I mean, it's a giant spaceship, and even though it's invisible, you could get seriously hurt. You're just running through the park and you run smack into the side of a big metal ship.
Well, look at those joggers get blown away by the downdraft as they're coming down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Imagine the radiation coming off of the engines there.
And when we see Dr. Taylor later in the movie, she actually does run right into the side of the ship and she doesn't even get hurt. She's just, oh, and just kind of falls backward.
Get a bloody nose or something.
Nothing. That ship has got to be made of some pretty tough stuff. She must have cracked something.
Kirk and Spock discover a pair of whales at the aquarium, at the Sausalito Aquarium, and they learn that soon those humpback whales are going to be released into the wild. So they decide those are the whales that we need. At the same time, Scotty, Dr. McCoy, and Sulu, they trade the formula for transparent aluminum for the materials that they need for the whale tank, how do we know you didn't invent the thing?
Because the prime directive is for suckers.
Right, exactly. We do what we need to do to get the job done. Also, I know that they were on a Klingon ship. They didn't exactly have a wardrobe department on the ship that they could just go and raid for late 20th century clothing or whatever. But I mean, Scotty's basically just wearing his uniform. The rest of them have on the civilian clothing. Sulu has really got some style. I don't know what kind of jacket he was wearing that's just kind of draped over his shoulders and everything.
Mm-hmm. There's an episode of The Big Bang Theory where one of the characters, Howard Wolowitz, fantasizes having a Sulu there.
I remember that.
Dream sequence. Yeah. He's in that same outfit.
I don't remember that. I mean, I remember the scene, but I don't remember him wearing that. That's cool. There was supposed to be a scene in this movie where Sulu meets his great-great-grandfather or something like that as a child. He hears a woman call out, Hikaru, and turns and sees this little kid run by and figures, oh, that's supposed to be my... But the kid that they got to do the part had a meltdown and started crying, and they couldn't film the scene, so it didn't happen.
They got real close to it. I think they have the kid running by him or something. They've got Sulu and who was he with?
McCoy and Scotty.
Yeah, they're like in front of some big Yellow Pages billboard on the side of a building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Someone comes out and yells something. That's the start of that scene.
And then they couldn't film the rest of it. So yeah. And then Sulu was also supposed to, the scene where he goes and talks to the guy at the helicopter, the way the scene was supposed to play out was the guy in the helicopter was supposed to get distracted and Sulu was supposed to jump in the helicopter and take off. But George Takei was sore because he had ran a marathon the day before or something like that. And he couldn't jump up into the helicopter. They tried to get a key grip to hoist him, but they couldn't make it realistic enough. So they just changed the scene to where he's just talking to the pilot. And then the next time we see him, he's flying the helicopter. And then, of course, we've got Uhura and Chekov, and their mission is to locate the nuclear vessels, the aircraft carrier Enterprise, and collect the photons from the nuclear reactor. And you get this hilarious scene of it being 1986, and you've got this Russian walking around asking people where they keep their nuclear vessels. Also, the woman that actually tries to give them directions, she wasn't supposed to say anything.
Yeah.
She was an extra, and actually her car got towed because it was parked where they were going to be filming at, and they let her be an extra so that she could make enough money to go get her car out of the impound. And when they asked her the question, she was just supposed to shake her head and walk off, and she just started talking. And they just used it in the movie. So she gave herself a speaking part.
Yeah, which I'm surprised they let that go, because normally Hollywood filmmakers don't love it when their extras just start talking and thus requiring that they get paid more, because they would have had to give her a lot more money if she suddenly had lines in the movie.
A speaking part, right.
Yeah. But, you know, putting that aside, because it strikes me as, oh, this is someone who is an extra, but they want some more screen time. So they're just gonna take a swing and see if they can become more important. And it worked. And there's part of that that just kind of rubs me the wrong way. But, you know, it's not the biggest deal in the world. However, it must be said that after... because she wasn't supposed to say anything. It was supposed to be silent. And she gives, you know, a full, like, two-sentence reply before walking off.
Mm-hmm.
Walter and Nichelle played that perfectly.
Yeah.
They yes-anded that moment in just the right way. Chekhov's response is hilarious. I'll admit it. That's what I said. I know that.
Now, I wanted to mention the scene when they first arrive out in the city. Kurt goes and sells the glasses at the pawn shop, which we'll talk about those glasses in just a second. He gets some money. He goes and distributes the money. He and Spock walk away, and Kurt tells everybody, spread out. You know, you look like a bunch of weirdos or something like that. They just kind of start wandering around. They don't really know what to do with themselves. And I'm watching that scene and I'm like, you know what? That actually makes a lot of sense, because they're not undercover operatives. These are a bunch of engineers that work on a starship. They don't know what they're supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. They don't know how to blend in. I want to talk about those bifocals for just a minute, mm-hmm. because there's a theory that I read that Kirk sells the bifocals to the pawn shop. Couple hundred years later, McCoy finds the bifocals in an antique shop and buys them, gives them to Kirk. Kirk goes back in time, sells them to the pawn shop. So there's this paradox. Where did the bifocals come from originally?
Yeah. And we were just in last week's episode when talking about the animated series episode, I mentioned a chicken the egg paradox, or by another name, if I'm not mistaken. I think I heard this on Doctor Who, but this would be a bootstrap paradox, wouldn't it?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's a nice theory. I like it. And it, it creates the possibility that Kirk is wearing glasses that are, you know, depending on which iteration of this time loop, they could be 1,000 years old.
Yeah, that's true. Well,
it really fits with the line that Kirk and Spock have in the antique store when Spock's like, you know, weren't those a gift? And Kirk goes, yeah, they will be again. That's the beauty of it. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And okay. So I want to talk a little bit about Chekhov gets captured at the Enterprise, the battleship. Uhura is able to get beamed up. She's got the photons that they had collected from the nuclear reactor. But then Scotty can't get a lock on Chekhov, so he gets captured. When they're interrogating him, I cringed when he said, when the guy said the word retard, because that's not a word that would get used in a movie now.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I understand it is 1986, but it's one of those things that you go and you watch a movie that was made 30 some odd years ago with today's sensibilities.
Sometimes it just kind of,
yeah. sometimes it just kind of shakes you. You're like, oh wow, listen to how casually that word was used, and it didn't mean anything back then, but then you, when you think about it, well, it was being used casually back then. It did mean something to someone, just nobody cared. Mm-hmm. And now they do, you know. But yeah, when I heard that word, I was, oh wow, I can't believe they said that. Well, I don't know why I can't believe they said that. They said that all the time in the 80s. I mean, it was a common phrase. But also, Chekhov's phaser doesn't work because of the radiation. If there was that much radiation, wouldn't it be killing all of them? Maybe it's the radiation. Chekhov gets out of that room fairly easily. You would think there would be a guard on the outside of the door or something like that. Have you guys ever been inside of a World War II era battleship before?
We've been inside a submarine before.
Okay.
I can't remember when it was in service, but
it was World War II.
Was it? Okay.
The SS Silversides.
Yep.
I don't know if they filmed these scenes actually inside the ship or if it was a set. I would assume that it was inside the ship. We have a ship a lot like this down in South Alabama at the in Mobile. It's the USS Alabama.
Oh, and Crimson Tide.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it there's a submarine there with it, so you can tour both. I've actually spent the night inside the battleship when my son was in scouts. They let us we had a camp out inside the ship. The hallways, I don't remember them being that big. He ran through that ship fairly easily. And there was a lot of people running around. I don't remember it. It was pretty tight quarters.
Mm-hmm. Well, he did look like he had his elbows tucked pretty close, and he was having to do that, you know, head scrunched into his shoulders while he was jumping over the lip of the portals going down the thing. And who knows, it was an aircraft carrier. They might have slightly bigger corridors and passages going through it.
And it's a post-World War II. So, you know, that was the USS Ranger. So it's a bit smaller than the Enterprise. But according to Memory Alpha and, you know, my Google foo, it was in service starting in 57. So I could see him being a bit bigger than like the
ship maybe. You were on or we've been on. Yeah, maybe. Maybe. That's true. Okay, so Jillian learns that the whales have been released early. When she slapped her boss, that was ad-libbed. That guy did not know he was about to get slapped. So his reaction was genuine. Jillian, Kirk, and McCoy, they go and rescue Chekhov from the hospital. McCoy puts the thing on his head that repairs the brain bleed that he's having because the doctors were about to drill into his head, and he probably wouldn't have survived that. And
subdural hematoma.
Yeah. And also the thing that they put on his head is interesting because that's actually part of a model of a Bird of Prey that they kind of repurposed and painted and everything. So it's a Star Trek model used as a prop in a Star Trek movie. So it's pretty cool.
Another bootstrap paradox.
Yeah. All right, so they get back to the Bird of Prey. They go and they save the whales from some poachers in Alaska, and they transport them on board. Scotty says, "There be whales here." And they take them back to the future. The whales respond to the probe's signal, causing the object to reverse its effects on the Earth and goes back into deep space. And then, because of their part in saving the planet, all the charges against the Enterprise crew are dropped, except for one, which is Captain Kirk's charge of, or Admiral Kirk's charge of disobeying a superior officer. They demote him to captain and give him command of a starship. So, like,
first world problems.
Yeah, we're demoting you, but we're rewarding you at the same time. And which is what he wanted.
The demotion was a reward because he didn't like being an admiral.
He never wanted to be an admiral in the first place. He got kicked upstairs. Kirk and Jillian part ways as she is being assigned to a science vessel by Starfleet, which it seems strange. She's only been in the future for a hot minute, and you're already putting her as a member of the crew on a starship. She hasn't even been through the academy. And also, her justification for going to the future with Kirk is that they're going to need somebody to know something about humpback whales in the future, since they're going to have humpback whales there. But she's leaving Earth, which is where the whales are. So the crew departs and they get on their newly christened USS Enterprise NCC 1701A and leave on their first mission. And that's the movie. Catherine Hicks played Jillian. And she was, it's interesting because she was the mom on Seventh Heaven for 1,000 years. And on that show, her husband was played by Stephen Collins, who played Decker in the motion picture. So a couple of Star Trek alum on that show. Stephen Collins is a dirtbag that I won't discuss further.
Yes.
Google it, folks, if you dare. So, some trivia for the movie. The idea of having Spock give the Vulcan nerve pinch to the punk rocker was inspired by Leonard Nimoy, who was, one day he was walking down the street in New York City. A punk came out of a store with his boombox blaring, disturbing everybody around him. Annoyed, Nimoy thought, if I really was Spock, I'd pinch his head off. So he put it in the movie. He didn't pinch his head off, but... James Doohan said that Admiral W. Wells here is his favorite line as Scotty. The scene written for but deleted from the film explained why Savick stays on Vulcan. She is pregnant with Spock's child. Stemming from an event in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, when she treated the young Spock's Pon Farr. This was the character's final appearance in a Star Trek film. I wonder why they cut that out of the movie. It might have something to do with like grown ass Savick having sex with a young teenage Spock.
Well, he was Pon Farr is something that happens every seventh year of a Vulcan's adult life. So it's entirely feasible that we can say that he was probably legal by the time that happened, because either, you know, every seventh year of his adult life, which means it happened, you know, when it first happens, that means you are an adult, and then it happens every 7 years after that, or do you become an adult and then
you become an adult when it happens, and then it happens every 7 years. That's what I've always thought. It happens when you reach maturity. It's like puberty. So your first Pon Farr would probably be sometime around 14 or 15, something like that. And then you would have it every 7 years after that. That's what I've always imagined. But
yeah, it's as good a headcanon as any. You know, yeah. Either it happens around 18 when you are, I'm using the human equivalent. It happens around 18 when you are an adult, and then it happens every 7 years after that. Or if it is puberty, 14, 15, then with the speed that Spock is growing, what's 7 years after that, he would have been, you know, 21, 22 equivalent when it hits at that moment. So I think we can safely assume that she's not really doing anything wrong, because in that five-minute span, Spock is old enough to...
He would have died if she didn't.
Well, there,
so it's also justified.
There's that. And so you can easily overlook the fact that since it was just the body of Spock, and with, you know, his Katra was absent, so it's not like you can reasonably expect him to consent. So that can get a little bit sticky. But he would have died, so we let it go.
Yeah. I understand why they didn't put it in the movie. There's a lot of... It seems like there's a lot of times when they wanted to make Spock have a child and then backed away. Because like Rick said in one of the episodes we did before, where there was a novel that was the sequel to All Our Yesterdays, Spock had a child with the lady from Sarah Beth. And a child with her in this book. And I'm wondering how many times writers tried to give Spock a child and they backed away from it at the last minute, or just decided they didn't want to go there or something. I know that in The Next Generation, season three, episode Sarek. Picard says
I met him once, briefly, at his son's wedding.
Yeah. Which we have to assume he's talking about Spock. Cause as far we, the only other son that we know of is, from Star Trek V. What's his name?
Sybok.
And I don't think it was his wedding.
I want to read that story where Captain Picard attends Sybok's wedding.
Yeah, yeah. The white backlit table that is used at Starfleet headquarters later became the center table in engineering on the Enterprise D for the Next Generation. Some of the shots of the whales were, in fact, 4-foot-long animatronic models. There were 4 models that were used, and they were so realistic that after the release of the film, U.S. fishing authorities publicly criticized the filmmakers for getting too close to whales in the wild to get footage. The scenes involving these whales were shot in a pool underneath the Paramount parking lot. The shot of the whales swimming past the Golden Gate Bridge were filmed on location and nearly ended in disaster because they were real whales. Nearly ended in disaster when a cable got snagged on a nuclear submarine and the whales were towed out to sea. I don't understand why there was a nuclear submarine under the Golden Gate Bridge. Is that something that happens all the time? Obviously, I guess. The film was originally supposed to have Eddie Murphy. This was supposed to be a different film. It's supposed to have Eddie Murphy, and he was going to see the Bird of Prey fly over. He was going to be like at the Super Bowl, and the Bird of Prey was going to fly over. And apparently everybody in all of attendance of the entire Super Bowl all thought it was part of the show, except Eddie Murphy. And he knew that they were real. He was a UFO buff or something like that. Paramount declined the script for 2 reasons. They didn't want to combine their 2 most profitable franchises, which was Star Trek and Beverly Hills Cop. And Eddie Murphy signed on to do The Golden Child instead. Gene Roddenberry was initially pleased to hear that the film would be a time travel story, because he had been pushing for a time travel plot line in one of the films. He always wanted a story where the crew traveled back in time to attempt to stop the Kennedy assassination. But Harve Bennett always thought that it would be anticlimactic because the audience would know they can't change that. That actually happened. You can't change that.
they could have gone for a big swing, and in the movie they do prevent the assassination, but that somehow leads to the eugenics wars, and that's how they can explain that Star Trek takes place in a reality other than ours.
Or that's the Mirror Universe. That's how it got started.
They did an episode of, there was an episode of Red Dwarf where they went back in time and they stopped the Kennedy assassination. I think they stopped it accidentally. And it changed the future so much that they had to go back, and Kennedy actually became the second gunman on the grassy knoll and killed himself.
See, I was going to say something about, you know, they did change, the crew did stop the assassination or changed it. They saved Jackie, you know, but
that's Quantum Leap.
I know. We need Christopher here. So.
Yeah, that one's for you, Chris.
Quantum Leap. While it's widely thought that Admiral Kirk was the biggest offender in breaking Starfleet's temporal laws, that honor should actually go to Chekhov, because before he escaped the naval officers, he threw his phaser at him. He left his communicator and his Starfleet ID badge, all of which were never retrieved and could have caused a major temporal paradox. Leonard Nimoy provided the low wub 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 sound that the cigar-shaped alien probe makes while it's flying through space. The sound effects editor came up with a bunch of different sound effects and played them all for Nimoy. He didn't like any of them. Oh, what do you want it to sound like? He said, I want it to sound like whoop, 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 whoop. So they took Nimoy and put him in a sound booth and had him do that for like 4 minutes. And then they mixed it with some other sounds, some whale songs and electronics and stuff. And that's what they used. All of this other stuff we've already talked about. So we did mention that it was not, the Star Trek 3 was not successful outside the US, and it was largely because outside North America, Ghostbusters was the movie that everybody went to see instead of Star Trek 3. So when they put out Star Trek 4, they called it The Voyage Home, Star Trek 4. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Now, there's nothing in the trivia about how, if you watch really close, at the end, when the crew is exiting the Bird of Prey through the top hatch off the bridge, you can see James Doohan fall off the ladder.
No, not in any of it that I found, but I have heard that before. Yeah. And also, Spock is laughing in that scene. He's got a big smile on his face, I guess. And that scene was done. They actually flooded the entire back lot at Paramount to do that scene with the sinking Bird of Prey. Also, one thing I wanted to mention, and I could be completely wrong. I wish Rick was here. He would set me straight. Spock is talking about having to adjust his algorithm or his math to make up for the weight of the water and the whales as they accelerate towards the sun. But they're in space. There's not any weight in space, right? It shouldn't affect their acceleration.
Well, Astrotrain had to drop, you know, they had to dump Megatron in Transformers movie. So, It doesn't get much more scientifically accurate than that.
Who eventually became Galvatron, voiced by Leonard Nimoy. So it's all connected. You see, it all.
There you go. There you go. It all comes around.
And just be a smart aleck.
So they might have mentioned weight in the movie. And I think you have a point. They're in space. Space, no one can hear you say this scale is lying, but it doesn't change the fact that their mass has altered.
Yeah.
The ship may not weigh more because you're in space, but there is more mass within the ship.
I guess. It's just, it seems like if weight and mass were a factor and things like that, then they wouldn't keep making bigger and bigger ships. Because the Enterprise D is like this huge ship, but it maneuvers just fine when it's in a battle and things like that. But I don't know. It's just when I heard him say that, I was like, I don't understand. What does this mean? But
I suspect it would not have been an issue as far as, you know, in his calculations. It wouldn't have been an issue if they weren't trying to, you know, break the laws of physics and travel through time. it's not a mass and velocity in space question. It's a temporal mechanics question.
And his guess worked out because they got back at the exact moment that they left. So I guess his guess was right. So, all right. That does it for our review of Star Trek IV. Before we go on to the Next Generation, the next thing we're going to do is we're going to start a thing between each one of these series. Like before we go into the Next Generation, we're going to pause and we're going to watch a movie that stars a actor that's very well known for Star Trek, but it's something else that they were in. The movie that we're going to watch first is William Shatner in Kingdom of the Spiders from, I think it was like 1978, something like that. But I think I'm starting a Patreon page for the network. I think that's going to be Patreon exclusive. So if you want to hear that, or it'll be Patreon exclusive, at least for a while, eventually it'll come out on the feed. But if you want to hear that, be paying attention to the Facebook page, the Twitter feed. There will be more information about how you can become one of our patrons. And don't worry, we're not asking for much. You can become a patron and hear exclusive content for like $2 a month, $3 a month at the most, something like that. If you want, I mean, for $10 a month, we'll give you a lot more. But I'm ironing all that out. It's not set in stone yet. So just be paying attention. And you'll hear about all that in the future. But our next official episode of this series, we'll be moving into the Next Generation. We'll start with Time Squared in the Next Generation. So we'll have that. That'll be here in, as you're hearing this, it'll be here in a week or so. So as we're recording this, a couple weeks. All right. Tom, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much.
And Scott, thank you as well.
You know, I'm always here.
And that's going to do it for us. I want to thank everybody for listening. And I did not write a catchy little saying at the end, so we'll just talk to you next time. Bye-bye.